Yeah.
All right.
This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G. here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this fine evening?
Good. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good. I hope everyone survived April Fool's a couple days ago. I was lucky enough not to trip over any big pranks or anything. Dr. Lyle, how about you?
I managed to survive it. All good.
I did see
a little video of, who is that famous guy that did the... Did all the nature shows, David Attenborough, and he was showing these penguins that there were a new species that flew away from the South Pole. And I'm watching this thing, and I completely don't know what's going on. I'm wondering, it doesn't make any sense to me. And then they got me. I was like, I don't get this, and I don't understand it. But there it was at the end, April Fool. So that was good.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. Yeah, I had read a story of somebody who got called into a family meeting due to some family emergency, and it turned out that somebody in the family was getting a divorce because somebody cheated on somebody else, and it happened to be on April Fool. So the person just stands up and says, "I give you guys full round of applause. Your acting skills are 100% on point," and then realizes it wasn't a joke. So yeah, good luck.
Oh my goodness! All right, that's good.
Yeah.
All right. So what's going on?
All right. Well, so today we have one of the questions that we didn't get to last week on the ego trap episode. So we're going to start with that one. And then we got a couple of questions on your views. You had made some comments about banning things and whether or not we should ban things. And so the question is geared towards that. And then we've got a question from someone who's originally from Northern Ireland and has a question about politics for making a better government, which should be interesting. And then we've got a question about a person who's having a personality conflict with their business partner. And then if we get to the last question, it's about a listener's teenage daughter who's addicted to fast food and wondering what she can do, if anything, about this, or if she should just wait. So let's just get right to the first question.
All right.
So Dr. Lyle, how do you reconcile the ego trap with what's called the Pygmalion effect, where others' expectations of a target person affect the target person's performance?
That's interesting. I just had this question at True North on a lecture this weekend. So just by sheer bizarre coincidence, this effect was researched by the Harvard social psychologist Robert Rosenthal. I think it was in the 1960s, and it became a famous thing. So here we are talking about it, 50 years later. The bottom line was that it's been sort of misreported over the decades. The original effect was interesting and got obviously a lot of attention because it suggested that this had a lot of implications for education and essentially if you could have a kid expect or have a teacher expect that a kid was going to do well I don't know if we heard this. Here's what it was. So what Rosenthal did was he told teachers that certain kids had been identified that they were likely to have an academic growth spurt in the next year. And he had just picked these kids at random, but he told them that, you know, they had taken this special test and the test had predicted this. And so then sure enough, when they looked later on in the next year, those kids were doing better. So this was the evidence of sort of the teacher maybe unconsciously having an impact on and encouraging a kid, and therefore the kid believes in themselves more, and then they, you know, get better, et cetera. This is ludicrous. That's not what happened at all. What happened on a postmortem analysis of these studies and these effects was that the teachers felt pressure from the fact that some academic expected some kid to do better, and if the kid didn't do better, the teacher was going to look like a bad teacher. So the teachers started hustling around with these specified individuals and coaching them about tests that they were going to take, and essentially gave them a hell of a lot of extra attention and really did everything possible to bend over backwards to see to it that these kids would perform better on any kind of assessment device. So it had nothing to do with the kid actually getting smarter or actually having any academic growth spurt or anything else. It just had to do with essentially making the outcomes of this thing entirely reactive. And as soon as the kids went to the next grade, it was all gone, never to return. So that's the the notion of what's called expectancy effects or this sort of thing doesn't fly. They're not there. Now, so let's look at this in juxtaposition to the ego trap and see if there's anything in here, or there's any details in here that are interesting at all. There are just a little bit, so there is no Pygmalion effect per se. But what there can be, if you think about the person's situation with respect to social expectation for their performance, there are essentially three broad scenarios that can be demarked on a continuum. That it's actually a continuum of assessment of what other people's expectations are of me. Number one, I can think that the expectations are too low, at which point I'm insulted and I'm highly motivated to demonstrate that they're wrong, that they're not giving me enough credit. So if they think that I can't do X, then I'm highly motivated to do X. Now, one could argue that if I get feedback that you can't do X, that it may lower my self-efficacy or my estimation about whether or not I can do X, and therefore it might undermine my motivation. That is also true. Okay, so there's essentially two factors here that feedback from others can influence a person's personal assessment of whether or not that they can do something, and whether their assessment of whether or not they can do something is going to be what we might call their self-confidence, or actually it's what we technically call their perceived self-efficacy or their perceived probability of success. And that perceived probability of success is the result of essentially three factors make up the vast majority of the variance associated with a person's confidence or their perceived self-efficacy. Just to be very technical, their perceived self-efficacy is the calculation that the mind goes through as it runs a probability assessment on the likelihood of success. Confidence is the emotional result of the self efficacy computation. In the same way that whether you calculate whether you've been treated fairly or unfairly is the computation, and then anger is the result of an emotional response. So just to keep in mind that these are essentially two different facets of the same phenomenon. We could just call it confidence, but I get, you know, with respect to Albert Bandura, who spent a large part of his career detailing out how this works. We want to be precise if we're a psychologist talking about this. So really, we're talking about perceived self-efficacy, or your perceived probability of success. So so our perceived self-efficacy is going to be the result of the three primary factors. are going to be your own personal history with respect to the endeavor. So if you're really good at math, and this is just another math test in a long line of tests in your calculus class, and we're into the semester and you've been taking all the quizzes in the book, and we're now on a new part of the thing, you have very high confidence. Your high perceived probability of success as you walk into the next test. No problem. Okay, so why is that? You don't care what anybody tells you. You already know because you personally have already done something extremely similar. So this is your personal estimation based on your own personal experience. This is the most powerful influence on your perceived probability of success or your self-confidence. Now, a second line of evidence is what do knowledgeable people think? Okay, so if you don't know anything, so for example, let's suppose you're a judo player and you know you're a pretty good player and you're about to go against some other guy, and your coach comes over and says, "Oh, look out, this guy is really, really tough. You know, you just better just grab on and hold on for dear life and just try to get a draw." Okay, well, now your coach knows more than you do, and you assume that he's got information now that you don't have. And so, therefore, that's going to influence your perceived self-efficacy with respect to this match. So this is another line of evidence. The third line of evidence is going to be how relevant others or comparative others have done. So the coach tells you this, but your friend – who's about your size and strength and is one in your same little pool, the last round went out there and just threw this guy without any problem. And it's like, you know, your friend is about equal to you. So you're like, you know what? I don't really think I need to be terrified the way the coach is saying. So your mind basically uses these three lines of evidence: your personal experience, the experiences that you observe in relevant others, and the opinions of knowledgeable others. Those are the three lines of evidence that the mind uses to compute its perceived probability of success, which then generates a certain degree of confidence. Now, so the expectancy effects could potentially influence this would be knowledgeable others expecting that you could do something. And therefore, that could raise your perceived self-efficacy, which could then raise your estimation that the cost is of effort is worth the benefit because you're likely to succeed. So this is the notion that sort of straightforward linear psychology looks at, but it's forgetting that potential increase in perceived probability of success can be easily dwarfed by the ego trap, easily. So the ego trap is when we believe that other people have overestimated our likelihood of success. So there's three possible demarcations along this continuum: that they have underestimated us, so we believe that they are not giving us enough credit, and now we're excited about going out in that match because we think we're going to beat that guy, and our coach doesn't think so, and he's going to be in for a big surprise. So we're excited about it. Now, the other thing would be when we think other people are about right. So they think we can do X, and we pretty much think we can do X. So there's no particular influence there of the social influence of other people because it's not at variance with what it is that we think ourselves. And so therefore, there's not a lot of motivational addition or subtraction to that endeavor. We'll either do it because of the overall cost benefit or we won't. But it won't be being influenced by outside inputs. The third possibility is that they've given us too much credit. And if they've given us more credit than we believe we think we deserve, then this puts us in a position where we don't think we're going to live up to expectations, and that's the ego trap. Now, you can see how easy it would be for so-called expectancy effects to walk somebody into the ego trap. Like, hey, Jimmy, you're going to start to do really well in math. You're really smart, and this test shows there's going to be a growth spurt. Really? Like, we think that that's going to cause this kid's self-efficacy to increase and therefore work harder and then have more success. I don't think that's very likely. And so could you engineer circumstances with individuals under individual circumstances? Could you find little nuances where there's the trade-off between the expectancy effects and the ego trap might tip in the direction of the expectancy effect, and you might increase motivational action as a result of that. Yes, I'm sure that that's quite possible. It's that could certainly be the case, and we've all seen it. So we've seen cases where we encourage somebody because we believe that they were underestimating their abilities in a certain area, and they were essentially being timid or avoidant about a challenge because they felt like that they were going to fail. When we instead said, listen, I think you're actually underestimating your abilities here, and let me explain why. Okay, because I believe that you've got more chops here in this situation than you're seeing, and let me give you the reasons why I think so. Now, that could, in some circumstances, be a winning ticket. In other words, the individual is not feeling too much pressure from the ego trap, but we've boosted significantly their perceived self-efficacy, and therefore their effort. Of course, that would be possible. But to think that these two things are not essentially diametrically opposed would be naive, because they are. And so, so in any event, this is a very good question about how it is that these would be related. And in my clinical experience, it's clear that the most dangerous thing that I can do is to walk people into the ego trap. I can see it immediately when it's happened. They immediately get timid and defensive, even though they seem to be being, in other words, I've been trying to reassure them, and it is potentially flattering that I have a higher opinion of their abilities and likelihood of success than they do themselves. So it's not entirely unpleasant to hear it, i.e. they are in fact receiving esteem, but it is now putting them under pressure of the challenge, and they're likely to lose it, and they're not at all sure. They feel like I've overestimated it. So whenever I do that, I immediately walk that back and put an ink cloud over the whole dynamic, and then slowly move our way towards a expectation that isn't too far above what they think they might be capable of. So, yeah, that's the story. So the big story of the question there is there big expectancy effects a la the Rosenthal effect or the Pygmalion effect? And the answer is no. Those have not been found to be clinically useful. And the only data out there that sort of gives us a look at this would be the mindset data generated by Dweck and her colleagues, which consistently show the ego trap dynamic.
Fascinating. And this is Carol Dweck.
Yeah, mindset. Fantastic. Mindset. If I have some parent that is dealing with a family system or a coach or a kid that we can see that they're in the ego trap, I send them to Carol Dweck's book called Mindset. It's clearly has the ego trap identified, the dynamic. Her analysis doesn't understand what's actually happening, but she identifies the pattern perfectly, and her research always comes up with the ego trap effect. In other words, if we praise too much, the kids, people go the opposite direction. So she actually says instead to do what she calls a growth mindset, which is to encourage that people's effort, which also works. What she doesn't apparently know is that the most effective thing is to insult them, because she's not actually aware that this is a problem of esteem dynamics. She's actually thinking that somehow it's this magical thing, a motivational mindset. Motivational mindset is a derivative of the esteem dynamic processes that are happening as a result of the esteem signals that are being inferred coming from outside parties or from an internal audience. So the analysis that we talk about here at Beecher Genes is a significant step more sophisticated than Dweck's analysis, but her analysis and her data are beautiful. In other words, her analysis isn't beautiful. Her analysis has there's some blanks that need to be filled in there. However, her research is pretty, and her results are crisp, and they always show the same result because she has identified this dynamic, which is clearly showing that if we put expectations too high, people are going to go the opposite direction rather than seize the high expectations and now rise to meet them behind a rising self-efficacy. So the idea that that was born with Rosenthal's early research has not turned out to be an accurate analysis of the situation.
Fascinating. Now, in order for someone to be in an ego trap, is they have to want to earn esteem from the person who's setting the expectations, right? Like if I just meet someone randomly on the street and say, oh yeah, mm-hmm. you're so great at this or that and the other, they're just going to look at me
right.
and say, good job. Whereas if I insult someone who wants to earn esteem from me, then that might, you know, that's completely different, right?
Yeah. I mean, obviously every situation that has any meaning at all, that has any significant motivational force to it, that's because the esteem that's involved is of significance. Mm-hmm. So I'm not so sure. I mean, I think it all pretty well works the same. So if someone in an audience that I had never met said, hey, I don't think that you could do this or that, I would instantly feel the insult. Okay. And I'd be highly motivated if I was sure that they were mistaken. I would say, no, you're mistaken. Let me show you why you're mistaken. Okay. So yeah, I don't think it simply all depends upon the, you know, who the esteem signaler is, whether or not we care about that esteem. But you wouldn't have to know the person. You would simply have to have a chip in your head that was reading that esteem was important. Okay. So that's why a heckler can be upsetting for a speaker, because you've never met the person before, but if they're heckling you or they're contradicting or challenging you, you can feel that you're going to lose, you're losing esteem with a bunch of the audience potentially. So now that what it is that they think and what everybody else thinks matters to you. Okay. This may not be anybody that you've ever met. There may be nobody in the audience that you know, but it doesn't matter. Your Stone Age brain is cataloging this as a nose counting event of esteem. And you're there to try to earn some esteem. And now if it turns out that that you're losing it, or you're getting evidence that you're being underestimated, then you're likely to get your bristles up and then try to attack it. Okay. So anyway, yeah, the dynamic I think is a universal dynamic of human motivation.
All right. Fantastic. Okay. Well, let's go on to the politics questions.
Right.
So Dr. Lyle, a few episodes ago, actually quite a few episodes ago, you
They're
talked
wrong,
about how,
whatever they think.
What's that?
I'm just kidding. Go ahead. Go ahead.
You know, I'm working on setting up a voicemail, a call-in voicemail for people who want to leave comments about the show. And this is going to fit in beautifully.
Okay. All right. Good.
All right. Dr. Lyle, a while ago, you talked about how we shouldn't ban anything, but this was in regards to people causing their own self-destruction with food and things like that. Do you think there's a place for intelligent preemptive bans on dangerous chemicals in children's toys or explosives, high magazine assault rifles, background checks for more dangerous weapons ownership, anything of the sort? If not, what do we say to people who have lost ones to these very preventable tragedies? Do we tell them at least you're free to do whatever you want? Is there a middle ground, or is common law and bringing tragic cases before a judge after the fact the only best way? Or do you think there might be some room for regulations, certifications, and preventions?
Well, why don't we just ask Doug Lyle his opinion of the universe here? This person is asking a whole bunch of questions, and there are different questions on the table here that can be viewed from a variety of perspectives. And I would say that in my personal political opinion, we begin with a philosophy, and the philosophy is that the government and government action is here to try to serve the interests of the individuals that are influenced by the government, that are working under or in the collective population that is under the rule of law of that government. So the notion is that essentially we want the government to govern optimally, and that means that in principle we want the maximum amount of freedom for those individuals with the least possible amount of government interference. Now, it turns out that if we have anarchy, in other words, we don't have a government, we're in trouble, because then we're going to get thugs taking over resources, and that's how that's going to work. So that won't work. So clearly, we have to have a rule of law, but the law starts to get to be fuzzy. So the law, I mean, in principle, the notion to optimize human life would be to essentially have you be able to do whatever the hell it is that you want to do in this life, so long as you aren't forcibly interfering with anybody else's rights to do the same. That would be a very reasonable principle. But now it starts to get a little touchy. Like, well, what do we mean forcibly? What if I just want to walk around naked? What about that? Okay. Am I forcibly interfering with other people's rights to not have to look at naked people when they don't want to do it? So that starts to get to be a little bit tricky about how it is that we might start to deal with these conflicts of interest. So obviously this question came up when I was talking about probably, you know, there's always some, you know, militant foodies out there that want to ban sugar. You know, there's always people talking like this. And so, and of course, my attitude is, no, we shouldn't ban anything of the kind when it comes to your own personal consumption. This is up to you. It's your body. You own it. And if you wanted to do things to it, this is your business, so long as you aren't forcibly interfering with the rights of other people to do the same. So, for example, it should be illegal to drive a car on the road under the influence of alcohol or drugs, or to drive effectively erratically because you're so short of sleep or whatever else the problem is. So if you've got a seizure disorder, so you're putting other people at significant risk. So just because you want to drive under the influence and it's inconvenient for you to call an Uber or have to pick up your car the next day, too bad. Okay, you are forcibly interfering with my right to have a reasonably safe highway. And so this is where, of course, there's always going to be these questions that then if we make that illegal, we've now clipped somebody's desire to do what it is that they want. But have we done it for an intelligent reason? And that reason is essentially trying to optimize the common good. So what the hell is the common good? Whose ox is being gored at what price? Okay, so what do we have? Gal, he's the young congressman from New York.
Oh, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez,
whatever her name is, yeah. Right? So these people, I'm very much out of touch, in case people didn't know. But the point is, I read something recently about how she was going to want to finance some things in government by maximally taxing wealthy people. Well, that's, you know, Robin Hood communistic thinking all the way down without understanding that this is not how you would organize an optimal society. Optimal society is you get to keep what you earn, except what we need for government functions. Okay. And if we start to tax the daylights out of people, we're going to disincentivize all kinds of creativity and responsibility. And so, Some people haven't actually ever been in like a business partnership where it turns out that, you know, you kind of feel like you're working a little harder than the other guy and he's not kind of working as hard as you are. So you're kind of pissed off because you're dividing it 50-50. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, the young congressman apparently hasn't had a few little basic experiences to help her understand that sometimes if you have one lazy kid and one kid that works hard, you kind of want to give the one that works hard the allowance and tell the lazy one they don't get anything until the lawn gets mowed. Okay, now, now when it comes to banning things, drugs, you know, if you ban heroin because there's heroin deaths, then what's going to happen is that you make you absolutely make for certain that there's going to be an underworld with all kinds of unenforceable contracts because these people are not operating under the rule of law. They're thugs. So you have anarchy. Okay. And so you just made certain that there's going to be all kinds of tragedies as a result of this. Now, you might say, well, what about my 16-year-old kid that died of a heroin overdose? Isn't that a tragedy? Yes, it is. But so are the people that got shot in the crossfire of a gang war for drugs. Okay, so this is once again the appropriate thing is to step back and say, wait a second. Let's try to figure out why we would want to ban anything. You know, what is the common good here? What is the price that we pay as we have government starting to take over and illegalize human activities where we're really, you know, for what reason? So now how would I look at these questions? Well, you would start with a philosophy that you would be very, very careful. And under great consideration, would you allow government to have any additional power? Okay, because the whole idea is, listen, I want to be as free as possible to do whatever the hell I want, so long as I'm not forcibly interfering on anybody else's right to do the same. If I take heroin, I'm not forcibly interfering on anybody else's rights to do anything. So I find it a bizarre concept that that would be illegal. Now you start saying, well, now, wait a second. What if heroin pushers start pushing it on little kids? Really? Okay, now you start, first of all, if it's legal, then it's not going to be particularly costly and there aren't going to be drug dealers because you could get it at the store. Okay, so now the question is, should it be at the store? Well, maybe not. Okay, and so now maybe there's an issue where you might want to use government to warn people and so on and so forth. And now this is where we start to wonder whether or not I should have a warning on my product and you don't have a warning on yours. This gets down to the fact that when we get to some of these conflicts, ultimately they are empirical questions. So we have to make what we consider to be the most reasonable trade-off decisions. And then from there, we can actually run very subtle experiments in principle. And we can look at other populations in other areas of the globe where they've done things differently and see what the outcomes are and see whether or not those outcomes look like they serve the common good. Okay? Even if they do and they appear to, it doesn't mean that we'll necessarily work with our population because our population may be culturally and genetically different than somebody else's population. And what works over there might not work here. So that means that these are ultimately empirical questions. So data, not principle, will sometimes have to drive the solution. Now, this discussion is all about how many angels dance on the head of a pin, because this is not how these things will ever get decided anyway. These are getting decided through political grandstanding and all kinds of basically, let's talk to the 100 IQ of the population and convince them of our position, that we're a good guy that believes in the thing that they believe in, etc. Okay, I can remember a cousin who is very highly intelligent cousin that was all for banning of drugs and big time DEA and all this kind of stuff. And I just looked at her like, oh, my God, you have no idea what you're talking about. You got 140 IQ and it's not being invoked because you haven't thought through the consequences of what it is that you're saying. So you have forgotten what happened in Al Capone, Chicago, apparently. Okay, so you have forgotten, you know, of what goes on with all the drug wars. So this is, but what we had was a very visceral reaction. She had a young daughter, and the idea of any drug being illegal within the United States borders just freaked her out and made her all upset. Okay, so that's that. That's like the end of discussion. There's no point in having a rational discussion about it. There really isn't. Because the truth is that these decisions will be decided in Washington and in the halls of power by people that are following, sniffing the cultural zeitgeist and where 51% of the vote is so that they can remain in power. Nobody's interested in testing this systematically and trying to integrate data and try to actually make the best decisions for the society. So The person's general question is, should we ban things? Undoubtedly, as they said, assault rifles and so forth. But remember, whenever you do ban anything, what do we get? An illegal trade, and a very dangerous illegal trade in the very thing that we've made illegal. Okay, so there's always, in all questions, there's always a cost benefit to any kind of government banning an action of any kind. And so we have to be as prudent as we can and then try to follow the evidence where it's available. That's the only rational way that I can see to proceed. And if anybody had a more brilliant way to do it, I'd be open to listening, but I don't think so.
Yeah, on that same topic, Milton Friedman has a really wonderful series called Free to Choose, where he goes over, I mean, it's about 10 videos, 10 hour long videos, where he describes different government problems. And then for half an hour, and then the other half hour, he's actually has a discussion with experts in the same ideas on both sides. And it's a wonderful, wonderful video series.
It's hilarious that you say that. That's where I learned it. Milton Friedman was absolutely one of the heroes of my youth. I believe he received the Nobel Prize in 1976, mm-hmm. I believe. Mm-hmm. And Free to Choose was, I think, made very soon after that. And as a young and impressionable young man, I watched Free to Choose with rapt attention. And the arguments, not only in obviously in the video, but in his very fine book that he wrote with his wife, called Free to Choose. Same arguments, same concepts that I'm using here precisely.
Yeah, it's a great series. All right, so our next question, yeah. Dr. Lyle, is in episode 27, so this question is quite old. It's about 2 years old. I think it was Goffman and his research on conflict that you referenced, mm-hmm. and the analysis inferred that women are more comfortable in conflict than men. With this in mind, could more women playing a leading role in politics make for a better government? At the moment, this is in 2017, in the UK and Ireland, there are at least 5 women as political leaders of some of the major parties. Given mm-hmm. Northern Ireland's violent past, could one be optimistic about the future with more women involved in key decision-making positions?
I think this is good thinking, and by the way, the author I would have cited would have been John Gottman, not Goffman. Mm-hmm. So, and it would have been Gottman's research specifically on romantic relationship conflict. So it's and it was specifically related to conflicts within romantic relationships where men are uncomfortable and want to get out of the conflict, ostensibly or perhaps. Because as they get angry, they can infer that they might become violent and they don't want to do so. Whereas the women are having no such compunction. And so they'll follow the guy around the block, chirping at him around what they're upset about.
mm-hmm.
So this is what Gottman discovered. So I don't think this really has anything to do with political decision making, et cetera, et cetera. However, that in general, I think women are in general going to be less glory hog, balcony seeking, et cetera. And the forefathers of this country brilliantly realized that the personal search for glory behind being a great warrior chieftain that wins was the greatest threat that there was to the Republic. And so this is specifically why they wanted to separate out the powers of government very carefully, because they did not want the executive branch to be able to say, well, I'm pissed at so-and-so, and now I'm going to go crush that country, and therefore glory goes to me because we just beat up Canada, okay? So the and women are probably, if we were to look at this from any empirical basis, they're probably a hell of a lot less likely to be seeking the glory behind such kind of victorious process. Men like the fight. And particularly men that want to climb dominance hierarchies have plenty of testosterone, and they love the thrill of victory. And women in general don't love the thrill of victory at the same level that men love the thrill of victory. It's a different animal. It has different evolutionary history. And so men obviously are potentially much more lethal and dangerous with a much greater desire and need for dominance. So, good thinking. So I think it's a fine thing that more and more women get involved with politics, because it probably in general is sort of acts as one more check and balance on the system, and sort of lowers down the tidal wave of desire for domination and glory that could be influencing decision making in our species. And however, in general, I don't have a lot of concern about gender specific talent. Individuals are more important than genders, obviously, and always will be. So that's what counts most. But as a general principle, yeah, I think this questioner has a point.
Fantastic. All right, Dr. Lyle, are you sick of the politics yet, or?
Yeah, enough. All right, go ahead.
Just kidding. Okay. All right, our next question. Dr. Lyle, I'm having a personality conflict with a business partner, and I'm just trying to figure out what the best way to deal with this is. Every time I try to talk with her and have a conversation with her about business or life in general, she always has a contradicting opinion that she makes known or acts as if she's trying to teach me something. This gets very frustrating, because it makes me feel like she thinks she knows better all the time and that I'm the ignorant one. I'm pretty agreeable, so I back down always and act respectful towards her opinion, but it's definitely not reciprocated. Every now and again, I have enough and lash out, which isn't what I want to do, and I always regret it, but it gets so frustrating for me every time it happens. She always backpedals and acts like she hasn't been constantly treating me like a child that needs to be taught. By the way, I have way more experience in the industry. I just don't want any conflict, and lashing out every now and then isn't working. What would be the best way to deal with a person like this? And why is it that someone might be like this? Or is it me? It's a confusing dynamic for me. I think the only reason we are doing great in business together is because I always back down, but it's definitely not helping me, because I stew about it and have secret anger. And maybe the only reason why we haven't fought to the death is because I pop in my headphones and listen to your podcast while I work.
Okay, first of all, the reason why you're doing well in business is because you are providing some product or service that your customers want effectively. That's the only reason you're successful in business. It's got nothing to do with your relationship structure. It has to do with what it is that you're providing. So my first question would be, how much of your life do you want to spend with this human? Because this human is never going to change. This is this woman's personality. Your personality is your personality. And therefore, this is always going to be a mess. So my first thought is you should be plotting your way how you're going to get the daylights out of this thing. Okay. And if you're not, I haven't begun to think about all the different ways that I can imagine that we would, I would need to know specifics about the business and the situation, et cetera. But certainly I wouldn't be talking to her about anything. And I wouldn't, I would be avoiding all possible conversations. And my conversations with her would be to a minimum of what needed to be discussed. In other words, what we're trying to do is to get your life as unoverlapped with her as possible. This is the concept of the disagreeable distance. So why is she like this? She's disagreeable. That's all. She's born that way. She's going to live this way, and she's going to die this way. And that's just how it is. There's never going to be a change. So she's going to be a pain in the ass the whole way. So the question is, do you want to spend the next 20, 30, 10, 15, or 40 years with this because you're in business with her? Maybe it was a good idea. Maybe she had talents and abilities that were useful in forming a business together that you couldn't do independently, and now it's been successful. Good. Lesson learned, and you have been successful. Now see how you can figure out how to separate as much of the business process as you possibly can, including splitting up the business, okay? But if you can't do that, if all we're trying to do here is, survive day to day with a disagreeable pain in the ass who's our business partner, then there would certainly be a few things that you might be able to do. I had a client once that would that would ask me advice. He would always be in some kind of a normal life jam, and he would ask me my advice, and I would give it to him, and then he would immediately contradict me and disagree with me. Now, I had to be hit over the head about 50 times. So I didn't see him that often. I'd see him maybe once a month. And so after about 5 years of this, I finally caught on. So I keep walking into the same trap because, it just seems so reasonable. He'd stew and have a 20-minute soliloquy about his little situation. And then he finally asked me what I thought, and I'd say, well, this is what I think. And, no. Now he's going to disagree with me. So I finally got smart. I mean, you only have to stub your toe so many times on the same door jam before you finally eventually figure it out, at least for most of the time. And I did. So what I did was he would ask me that question, and I would equivocate, which isn't like me. So I'd say, I'm really not sure. I really see issues on both sides of the equation. What do you think? I went back to dumbbell shrinkhood 101. Just do it the way all the other shrinks do it. So that's what I did. And it would frustrate him. I'd just sit right there in the middle. And then when he started leaning one way, I'd say, well, you got a point. But I could still see both sides. And I just let him frustrate him. And this kept me out of this uncomfortable situation of being, he would have an irritated contradiction when I would give my opinion, and I got tired of it. It was a waste of time. So I did what I could to drop the insurance carrier that he had. Yeah. So anyway, that's what can we do? You can use essentially Socratic method by asking her questions like, well, now what are you thinking? I'm just interested in hearing your perspectives on this from all sides. And when she asks you what you think, well, I'm really not sure. What are you thinking? I can see things both ways. And just try to put ink in the water so that we aren't really having a substantive discussion, and that we'll just sit there and let her spin and then go the direction that she's probably going to go anyway. So, the blowing up comes from getting so frustrated that you've been treated unfairly enough that you're signaling then with your anger that the other person should feel guilty and back off and concede to a basic standard dynamic. And this will happen with pleasant people. They will take it and take it and take it and take it. And then when they blow, they believe that they have achieve sufficient capital by being so overly fair time after time in conflict that now finally you have to give because I have given so often, now by God you have to give. Okay, what we find is that the other person wasn't thinking that they were giving at all. They just thought that it all was perfectly fine and reasonable while they were taking 80-20 all the way down. So when we finally squawk, it turns out it doesn't work very well. So then what happens is we squawk louder. So we go through a very quick escalation cycle to put more and more chips in the middle of this table and basically let them know, no, I'm really fed up. I'm now volatile, for God's sakes. I'm so pissed off because you're not reading the cues and you're so damn unfair, and I've been putting up with this shit for a long time and I'm done. Okay? When you get there, you often will find out to your amazement and disgust and horror that wasn't enough. Okay. It's like you just hit an anvil with your hammer and nothing happened. The hammer bounced right back in your hand. This means you should read this as the following cue. You're in the wrong place. Okay. You're dealing with an 80-20 pain in the ass trader that's never going to be the same. So the real answer to your question is get the hell out. Okay, maybe it takes a year, maybe it takes a month, maybe it takes 5 years, but plot your way out of this mess. And in the meantime, do your best to invoke the disagreeable distance in all manners possible. And that includes when discussions come up, You go to Socratic method. You just ask questions and shrug your shoulders, and that's that. And you try to stay out of situations where she's lecturing you about how you're wrong. That's how I would do it.
Fantastic.
I.e., get a divorce. Okay. All right. What else we got?
All right. Our last question, we're kind of circling back around from the ego trap question from the very first beginning of the show. And now we're going to deal with a listener who says, Dr. Lyle, my teenage daughter is addicted to fast food. She stopped eating at home. And at the end of every week, I find several empty pizza boxes, milkshake cups, French fry containers, cupcake boxes, pints of ice cream, etc., or more shoved under her bed or between her mattress and the wall. She's gained 60 pounds in the last 3 years. I worry about her so much. She says she likes the taste of food and she doesn't want to give it up. She says she doesn't care if she gets cancer at a young age. She wants to enjoy her life. Am I just supposed to sit on my hands and wait for her to hit rock bottom in 10 years?
Oh, all right. Let's see. We sort of circled back to people ought to do whatever the hell it is they want to do as long as they're not forcibly interfering on anybody else's rights. So the daughter's eating behavior isn't forcibly interfering on anybody else's rights. It's interfering on mom's desires for her, but mom's desires for her, that kid has her own life. So the general answer is, yeah, kid can do what they want. Number two, I want to make sure that you understand that your daughter's eating behavior now has nothing to do with whether or not she's going to get cancer. Okay. So if you've told the kid that she's going to increase her likelihood of cancer by eating the crap she's eating, then you've unfortunately been operating under a misunderstanding that has caused a lot of unnecessary anxiety. So if a kid is eating crap with both hands through their teenage years and their 20s and their 30s, it is not appreciably altering their statistical likelihood of getting cancer. And they're sure as hell not going to die particularly early as a result of it. So that's kind of off the table. Now, I did write a book about this. It's called The Pleasure Trap. So in it, The Pleasure Trap is an exploration of why this is an unbelievably slippery problem and very, very difficult to essentially deactivate it. And in fact, my good friend, Chef AJ, is going to have me do a little class that she's offering to her people. That if you go to her website, you can get this class where I'm going to be pontificating about the pleasure trap for 6 weeks in a row, which I've never done. I just can't think of much more exciting than just running my mouth about this, which I will with delight. But your kid is not going to get cancer, and your kid is in the pleasure trap, as we would expect. In other words, I would expect essentially every teenager in the United States to be in the pleasure trap. And we can see that it feels bad to look at a girl that's gained 60 pounds, because we know that there is a lot of emotional impact that comes with this. Another little thing actually that comes up about this that I have a question about would be, where's the kid getting all the money for this? That's a little odd. So if this girl's out there hustling and earning her own money and then buying her own food and turning up her nose at the food that you provide, that's one thing. But if she's got a credit card or a big fat allowance that's allowing her to eat a bunch of pizza and milkshakes, then hey, cut off the money for God's sakes. There's no reason to facilitate this process by making those resources easy to get. They're expensive, and that's forcibly interfering on your rights to spend those resources in a way that you would want. So I'd be very curious about where the resources are coming for such expensive fare. And in fact, I heard of a case where a rather remarkable young woman asked her parents to cut off her money because she was getting into trouble with the food. And she did. She had the parents do that, and it was helpful, interestingly enough. So let me think. So make her earn her own money for the pleasure trap. But the pleasure trap that she's in now, she's likely to get very interested in this problem as she gets increasingly interested in boys and it becomes more important to her life later. This will very often happen with young people, that they're really not that interested and focused on sexual competition in their teens. But as they get a little bit older and they start seeing the handwriting on the wall that they essentially are going to have to deal with this or not, then that would be a time later when she's more likely to change her cost-benefit analysis about this. And there you'll be with a copy of AJ reading The Pleasure Trap, the auditory copy that you can give to your daughter and have her just listen. Doesn't even have to read it. But don't give it to a 16-year-old. We're wasting our time.
All right, fantastic. I really feel for this teenage daughter, but hopefully she gets the right information someday. Maybe she will, maybe she won't,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but her mom's got the information, so she's going to hear the information, and she's going to know it's there, and it's going to be sitting as a little resident memory sitting inside of her mind. And more than once, in fact, many times, I have watched young people turn it around when suddenly they knew they needed to get serious and get competitive. And so just like people will do this in the divorce process, we call that the divorce diet. Like suddenly everybody loses 25 pounds miraculously. Okay?
Hit the gym.
So
what
happened?
Hire a lawyer, right?
What did you say? I was too entertained with myself, but I caught the end of it.
Sorry, I interrupted. No, I said the divorce diet is hit the gym, delete Facebook, and hire a lawyer.
Very good. There you go. So just as that happens, so this young lady will start to have increasing cognitive dissonance when there's more important issues on the line, but not now. So don't worry about it. Let's go after the money, and otherwise let's not worry about her health, for goodness sakes, because that's not on the table, and we'll worry about the rest later.
Fantastic, Dr. Lyle. We love it. And hopefully someday the right person encourages her and the right person insults her.
You got it.
All right, Dr. Lyle, that's it for this evening. I really appreciate you coming on, and we'll look forward to speaking with you with more questions next week.
Perfect. Thanks, Nathan.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.